the canine condition. Come, sit, stay. Welcome to season two of the Canine Condition Podcast. I am your host, Jackie Pignol. Each episode is a conversation with a trustworthy dog rescue organization or animal welfare advocate that will leave you inspired and empowered. This is the why, where, and how to adopt or help a canine family member. The goal is to save homeless dogs and set you up for success with information and resources to raise and keep a healthy and well-balanced dog. Embark on this journey with me, and let's save humans' best friend together. With this podcast, I am determined to find options so that we as pet parents have an easier time not only adopting our furry family members, but so we can have access to what we need to properly take care of them their whole lives. This is a very unique episode with a guest who is going to bring us a lot of information about the most important thing we need once we have a dog or a cat, their food. What are we feeding our furry best friends? My guest on the podcast today is Daniel Shuloff, an entrepreneur, activist, and science writer. Daniel has a focus on exposing the conflicts of interest, bad faith, and shoddy science responsible for the chronic disease epidemics killing millions of our pets every year. Daniel is going to talk to us about his book on the subject, which you can download for free on his website. And we are going to get firsthand information about his own dog food brand, Ketona. Daniel ventured into making a dog food he felt was good enough and healthy enough to feed his own dogs. And personally, I want to find out all about it. Welcome to the Canine Condition Podcast, Daniel.
Thank you, Jackie. It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. We are going to have a fascinating conversation. This is the first time I have the pleasure of having a conversation with someone who's going to tell us all about proper dog nutrition, healthy dog nutrition for all of those dog parents and animal lovers out there. I wanted to start with this idea that came to mind when I knew we were going to get to have a chat, which is you are what you eat. And I think we've all heard that at one time or another. And we usually apply it only to humans. But I want to propose to my listeners and to anyone you might share this episode with that we apply that also to our canine companions, that we think about them also in terms of they are what they eat. And with that, I'm going to let you take it away, Daniel, and tell us, how did you get started in canine nutrition and why? Was there a dog or an event that sparked this journey for you?
Yeah, there certainly was. Once upon a time, a longer time ago than I care to admit these days, I was living in the city of Atlanta, and I was working as an attorney at this big international law firm where I did intellectual property litigation. And I was a single, yuppie, living in a city guy, and I got a dog. And I had grown up with dogs. My mother raised, like, she had golden retrievers, and once a year she'd breed them and have a litter of puppies. And so we had puppies around all the time, and I grew up with dogs. But this was my dog as an adult. He's since passed on. He was a Rottweiler, and he was something of like a quintessential Rottweiler, you might say, in that he's very large. He was very intense, had protective instincts, and his behavior could be influenced by exercise, as I'm sure being an experienced person with behavior, you know this as well as anybody in the world, but he had to have a bout of daily exercise in order to be a polite member of society.
Okay. What was his name?
His name was Cody. Someone else came up with the idea that he looked like, there's a kind of bear that's a Kodiak grizzly bear. And when a Rottweiler with its little like dog tail is a puppy, it looks a bit like a bear cub. And so it came from that, yeah. But anyway, he was a great dog. And in the course of trying, you know, I'm a busy guy, trying to make time to exercise him, and I'm trying to understand how to do that better. And I'm reading papers. This is like, you know, I, for a living, would try to get familiar with these arcane scientific topics that I knew nothing, you know, intellectual property involving like aircraft design or voiceover IP technology, stuff like I knew nothing about going in, but then you have to become something of an expert quickly. And so I tried to basically recreate that process around exercise for him. It was just like, okay, how can I do this most efficiently, effectively for him? And in the course of doing that, I learned some, you know, your dog is what it eats, facts that kind of blew my mind and ultimately were like the primary cause in getting me to where I am now, which is they surround the issue of obesity in dogs. Two facts, kind of particularly, juxtaposed together made zero sense to me. Number one, obesity is worse for dogs than a lifetime of smoking is for a human being. Studies have been conducted where different groups of dogs, two very similar groups, are basically followed over the entire course of their lives. And the only thing that's different is one group is somewhat fatter than the other. They feed them more, they feed them a different kind of food, and they wind up somewhat fatter. So not colossal, barely able to walk, belly dragging in the dirt dogs, but somewhat overweight. And they find that the lifespan of those dogs is cut short by a greater extent than a lifetime of smoking for a human being. So a huge, hugely impactful thing. And yet, fact number two, more than half of the dogs and cats in the United States today are overweight or obese. So this is just as a matter of math. We hardly know each other. I cast no judgment. But if I were to meet your dog, it is more likely than not that that dog is a pack-a-day smoker. And it just blew my mind. It's just like, how could this? No way. It's so easy. Like, we don't have to avoid the delicious foods that are fattening when we're feeding our dogs. It should be the easiest thing in the world. And the explanations that you'll hear when you start to research this issue typically center around blaming the owner in one way or another. It is typically either we're loving our pets to death or we're too lazy. We don't exercise ourselves, and so we don't exercise them, or we're kind of stupid. We're just not hip to the idea that obesity is bad for a dog. None of that made sense to me. It seemed there was more to the story, and I started kind of digging in earnest. And eventually, I just like it went from being a personal project to a commercial one where I started working on a book. And I eventually got so deep into it, the further I went into the story of like, what are vets taught about nutrition? Where does this come from? What role does industry play? The more like incredible it got. And it became this like big thing. And I quit my job and spent 4 years writing this book. And the book tells the story from my perspective of why obesity is really a problem among pets in the Western world.
Okay. And for my listeners, since this is audio only, I will tell you, show me that book. He's showing me the book. I'm going to read you the title. My listeners can go look for it. It's called Dogs, Dog Food, and Dogma. And I will also add a link to your book for listeners at the end of the episode, because I always think it's helpful for everyone to go look for themselves and not just take our word for it. You know what I mean? And research on their own.
It's the single best piece of advice that I can give when I'm talking to pet owners about what I think is the best thing they can do for becoming a better, like knowing more about how to feed their dog. It's like in this day and age, despite the fact that there are media like the one that we're on right now, where you can hear from people like me directly, there are such a diversity of opinions and perspectives that if you are not able to just bring yourself like a kind of certain amount of scientific literacy, you're always at risk of having the wool pulled over your eyes. And you really need to be able to do, to some degree, your own research in order to feel really confident that I'm not a charlatan or that the next person that comes along is correct in what they tell you. And so fully agree.
Yes, I think we have to be, and as much as you know, on this podcast, we advocate for dog adoption and dog rescue. I also even say to people, don't get a dog if you're not ready. If you haven't done the homework and set yourself up, because yes, we want to save dogs, we want to empty shelters, but we don't want them to be adopted to the wrong home or have you take on a dog and feel like, oh my God, this is the worst thing I've ever done. So it's the same thing with anything we add into our lives. And I'd like to use this opportunity to set adopters up for success. If you didn't adopt your dog, if you bought your dog from a pet store or a breeder, you know, my listeners on a weekly basis know how I feel about that. But I say to you pet parents, maybe you'll adopt one day, but at least if you do have a purebred dog, a dog that you bought, those dogs are also prone to a lot of disease, certain illnesses that come from genetics, and proper nutrition is super important for those dogs too. So this really is a podcast episode for everyone. It doesn't matter where you got your dog.
There's never been a moment in history where pet owners have spent more on veterinary care. there's never been a moment in history where the pet products industry has been larger. We all, you hear it all the time, right? We treat our pets as if they are family members. They are family members in most definitions of that term. And nutrition is something that, unlike so much of the things that we spend money on because we want the best for our pets and we're willing to give them whatever we feel like they need, nutrition is something where there's real scientific evidence that you can do good things for your dog. And unlike so much, so many products that you see these days, there's just feels good, I'll purchase it, maybe it'll make a little bit of a difference. And we're talking about a lifetime of smoking. And it's half the dogs in the country. Half your listeners right now may not realize it, but their dog is, by the technical terms, is overweight. And it's like something you can manage really easily.
It's so interesting. And, you know, I've learned because I have a pack of six. So I know I started with two, then three, then, of course, four and five, six. But the rescue journey took us on that path, my husband and I, as we were filming and as we are on this journey of advocating and helping organizations across the country. And I've noticed mostly is that in the dog rescue world or when dogs are adopted out, these organizations are donated food or given food, or people can go on Amazon and purchase on the wish list. But if the food's too expensive, people might buy the less expensive food. You know, we live in a world where, yes, TV commercials and ads and magazines and buses ride by with big, you know, you see the titles of the food that sometimes make you think, oh, holistic, whole this, whole that. So the words catch our eye and we go, that must be really healthy and it's cheap, so I'll get it. On that note, what is it, where are we missing the mark as consumers? Are we just looking at an ad and being sold on that and not doing the homework, like you said? Should we be doing a certain type of investigation when we buy that kibble?
That's my advice. I'm not prone to blaming consumers because the pet food market right now is such a difficult place to be a consumer.
Oh, there's so many choices, Daniel. I get overwhelmed. I'm like, oh, these are all human-grade cooked food, human-grade raw, kibble, freeze-dried, hydrated. I'm like, oh my God.
But here's the thing, is that stuff where there's like really good evidence that it does healthy things for your dog's body is not typically a part of like the shopping vocabulary. Like the things that make up little subsectors of the industry, like buzzwords like grain-free or human grade, usually, and in both of those cases, have zero documented. There's no study that says like, if you do this, it's likely to be better for your dog. In neither of those cases. There are types of things where you can say that, where you can say, oh, look, we have a whole series of studies here that seems to suggest that if we do this, that, or the other thing, it's going to be better for the dog. But it tends not to be the little market sub-demographics. And the reason for that, in my estimation, as I explain in the book, largely is because it's a horribly regulated industry. Unlike a lot of places, a lot of like places where folks spend money, the pet food industry is essentially regulated by itself. Rather than government doing its job and enforcing rules on how pet food needs to be prepared and labeled, which they do to a very small degree, the organization that wields all the power in figuring out what you can and cannot and have to and don't have to say on a pet food label is a private industry organization. It's funded by pet food companies. And as you might imagine, it tends to represent their interests very well, much more, I would argue, than it does protect consumer interests. And so you get all sorts of ridiculous rules that, like, if you wrote a 400-page book about pet food, you might understand, but the average Joe is just like not hip to at all. And it's just a horrible situation. It's just really, really difficult. And so I empathize hugely with consumers. I don't blame them at all.
It's hard. It's taken me a long time to find something that each of my dogs can eat. And there are three of them are on different diets. So I have all different kinds of foods because not all my dogs can eat the same one. It took a long time to find that out because I felt misled. And I like to say kind of misled for corporate profit. I feel like those companies are selling me an ad and I'm buying into the lingo, but I'm not getting what it's actually saying. I wanted to read a quote that I saw on your website, which is going to kind of it enlightened me to think differently about how I feed my dogs as well. And and I'll let you expand on this more, but it says, the evidence has reached a tipping point. It's simply undeniable that dogs shouldn't eat carbs. It's no longer debatable. It's just a matter of time before all pet owners understand that reality. That is a very passionate choice of words as I'm reading it, and pretty definitive. Tell me why you have found that to be true.
So my book kind of advances two main theses. One is a cultural theory, and the other is a scientific one. The scientific one is essentially that carbohydrate is the devil when it comes to dogs and cats, that it does unique things within your dog's body that other nutrients don't do, and that those things are linked with disease and bad health outcomes in real tangible ways. I'm not talking about a shinier coat, and I'm not talking about a better joie de vie and energy. I'm talking about disease prevalence and lifespan. And these are real, well understood phenomena, and there's a deep body of literature that shows it. And, you know, half of my book, like I said, is just this study says this study says that. It's just a pop science book that walks through the literature. But the other half is this cultural issue, which is like, so I did all this research, I see all these things, and I buy all the veterinary nutrition textbooks that are used to teach rising veterinarians about these subjects in America's veterinary schools. And it's not discussed. You don't see, I mean, I'm talking about this, let me give you an example. This same kind of study has been done a half dozen different times, and the same outcome happens every single time. If you take two groups of dogs or cats and you feed them exactly the same number of calories and subject them to the exact same type of activity environment, so they're both being raised in the same kind of lab and they're both being given on a daily basis exactly the same number of calories, all you do differently is in one group, those calories come to a larger extent from protein as opposed to carbohydrate. And in the other group, you turn up the carbohydrate and you turn down the protein. If you buy the idea that a calorie, for purposes of weight gain and obesity, a calorie is a calorie, we should know exactly what would happen here. They're taking in the same number of calories, they're putting out the same number of calories, they should wind up with the same bodies. Only that's not what happens. It's never been the case that that is what happens. Every single time that experiment has been conducted, the same thing happens. The dogs that eat the same number of calories but a lot of carbohydrate wind up fat. The ones that eat the same number of calories but fewer carbohydrates wind up less fat. And not to a small marginal degree. There's the kind of landmark, the biggest study that was done in this space, and it was kind of like the most modern one. The dogs that got fatter got 6 times fatter, okay? They gained 6 times as much body fat over the course of 12 weeks, I think. And so it's this huge thing. And it's like, okay, this is as clear as day. This should obviously be something that is being taught to veterinarians. And it's not. It's completely ignored in textbooks. And so the second half of my book is like, well, why is that? That seems clear as day. And trying to understand that as kind of a cultural process. And so the second thesis that advanced in the book is that the reason that more lay people like us and medical professionals, your veterinarian, don't appreciate this reality about the evidence surrounding carbs as well as they ought to is because they're being actively misled by corporate interests that have a hugely significant role, not just at the regulatory level, but in the academic level as well. I don't think I have it in this room with me, but one of the big textbooks, there's only 27 vet schools, 28 in the United States right now. So it's like, I reviewed every curricula in the country in connection with my book. It's not that hard. You're not talking about a mammoth undertaking. And there's really only 2 or 3 textbooks that get used. And one of them, like kind of, you know, you're talking about an 800 page fat old textbook. You flip over and you look at the back cover. And on the back cover, there's a big embossed logo that says, courtesy of Hill's Pet Nutrition. It's literally produced by Hill's Pet Nutrition, the textbook. The editors of the textbook were full-time Hill's Pet Nutrition employees. And so by analogy, consider how you would feel if your human doctor you went to their medical school and you sat in on their nutrition course and you looked at the textbook that they were using. And on the back of that textbook, it said, produced by McDonald's or Coca-Cola, as I sit here with my Coke Zero Sugar next to me. But it would be an outrage, right? Nobody would stand for it. It is the norm. That is the standard in the veterinary world. There's just a lot less money in the field of veterinary nutrition than there is in human nutrition. There's no like NIH funding for animal studies. And so pet nutrition companies, pet food companies own the space. And so essentially those guys, those companies have a huge vested interest in having consumers believe carbohydrate is perfectly healthy for dogs and cats. And the reason you might be able to guess is carbohydrate is very inexpensive. Calorie for calorie, it's like 1/10 the price of animal protein. So if like a calorie of corn or rice or potato is phenomenally inexpensive when you compare it with a calorie of beef or chicken or seafood. And so there's always a pricing pressure for them to use more and more of it. And in order to prop that demand up, they wipe it out of the textbooks and do a bunch of other nasty things that I catalog in the book.
For me, it's simple in that I go, if it happens to us, surely it's going to happen to our dogs. It's going to happen to our cats. But some people don't make that connection as quickly, or they think that because we're a separate species that they must be different. And, you can just pour, cupfuls of these kibbles. Look, when I don't feed my dogs kibble anymore, I'll be honest. In 2020, we all had so much downtime. That was when I had the time to sit down and analyze what are my dogs eating and what's in it, right? And we're trying to move things around and sometimes save money. Stores weren't open. I would run out of one food and couldn't get it again. That kind of got my wheels spinning and going, okay, can I make their food? Can I supplement some of the kibble so I have, do you know what I mean?
Is that what you do now? Do you prepare it yourself?
I do. Sometimes I prepare it because some of the one that I buy, even though it's human grade cooked or fresh frozen, it's not available. They've run out. So I have to learn to cook it myself and the portions. And what I was getting at is that the kibble, when you look at the serving size, so I started to follow the instructions on a new kibble that was supposed to be, grain-free and fruits and veggies and protein only. And my dog, he got a little round. And our dogs are all slim. We're very active. And so I know when they've gained 5 pounds is a lot on a dog. If they've gained 2 to 5 pounds, I can see it.
What kind of dogs do you have?
Pit bull mixes. He's a brindle pitty, this one.
So like 70 pounds and less?
So, yeah. So they're less than 70. And the pug is about 18 pounds. If he puts on 2 pounds, oh, it's a lot.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm looking at these servings going, this is a lot of kibble every day. I couldn't, So I minimized it. And then I slowly transitioned out of it. And I've seen them do really well. What I like about, what I'm learning from your website and so intrigued is the idea that I also don't feed them carbs, but I do see even in your website, you have these cool little diagrams with how much carbs all the different brands of food have versus your keto natural pet foods, ketone, a dog food. Talk to us a little bit about that and how we can gauge what's best for our dog, what we're getting with keto natural pet foods when we use that food.
So before we existed, and if you were somebody that, like me, thought minimizing carbohydrate intake is about as important a nutritional issue as there exists with regard to choosing a food for your dog, you were not in a great place. The market was not a great place. Not only was it a difficult place to be a shopper, but the options, the kinds of products that are available for you were limited. You kind of had two strategies. You could feed the lowest carb kibble you could find. The problems with that at the time we were founded are myriad. Number one, the lowest you could find was like 30% carbohydrate. A third of the product comes from dietary carbohydrate. That's the lowest. Most products are 50% or more. The second is that it's hard to know how much carbohydrate is in any individual pet food because I mentioned the regulatory environment before. Here's my Coke Zero with the FDA's nutrition. We're not on video, but I'm holding up a can of Coke. And everyone is familiar with the FDA's required nutrition facts panel that goes on all human use packaged food products. And of course, one of the lines on that panel is the amount of digestible carbohydrate that's in the product. It's something that consumers are mindful of, that we understand it's important and we want to analyze it. In the world of pet food, in contrast, you're not allowed to mention carbohydrate in what's called the guaranteed analysis panel on a pet food label. Like for us, we were founded, we're going to make low carb pet food. And it was literally a challenge to communicate that to the consumer in labeling. There's an affirmative prohibition in the relevant regulations on using the words low carbohydrate. You can't, if you write low carbohydrate on your label, you are liable to be strict, like moved, taken off the shelves. And I can't tell you in the same way that Coke has to tell you how many grams of carbohydrate are in each cup. But so if you're a consumer, circa 2016, when I published the book, you, number one, even if you could do the math, there's ways you can back into the math if you know what you're doing. Even if you could do it, the best kibble you're going to find is 30% or higher. And the reason for that, not only is it our carbs inexpensive, but for a long time, folks believed that you needed to use carbohydrate to make kibble. Just very generally speaking, kibble is made sort of like pasta is made, or like meaty pasta, or like meaty bread. It's like you mix a bunch of ingredients. In the case of kibble, they include meat ingredients, into one dough, and then you heat it. You make it into little nuggets, and then you heat it up, basically. And when you heat it up, what happens is certain types of nutrients, particularly digestible carbohydrates, starch, melts down. It gelatinizes. And what that does is it holds all the other ingredients together. So, and you can see this for yourself. If you ever try to bake a loaf of bread without using flour, the dough doesn't want to hold together. It crumbles apart. And that same kind of thing happens with kibble if you don't put enough starch in there. So back once upon a time, when the American pet food industry was in its infancy in the middle of the 19th century, it was a mind-blowing thing that, oh my gosh, we can make this shelf-stable product that's kind of like baking biscuits, but we're going to put some meat in it. It's going to be great for dogs. Nobody knew that carbohydrate was bad for dogs. And so in a lot of ways, shelf stability, simple serving, keeps the dog alive. These kind of high carbohydrate kibbleized products became the norm. So that's, you know, basically why carbohydrate is used in kibble. And so if you had to feed kibble, you mentioned you have six dogs. That is
it's a lot.
God bless you. We have three. However, two of them are male St. Bernards. And so they're massive.
Whoa. So you kind of have six dogs.
Yeah, basically. But well, that's the thing, is like the difference in price, the second option, if you were a person that said low carb is what I want to feed my dog, your second option is I can find products that are truly low in carbohydrate content. They're just not kibble. A raw product or a fresh product doesn't go through that same manufacturing process that kibble does. You don't have to heat it up and get everything to hold together. You're either serving it up frozen or fresh or whatever. And so carbohydrate often isn't present in significant quantities in those kinds of products. So you could feed one of those instead. The problem with that is if you're somebody like me, the price difference, there's a term in pet food, unitize. They unitize the product somewhat differently than I do. You know, I sell a 24-pound bag of dog food, a lot of servings in each bag. Raw and fresh typically is smaller, so the kind of sticker shock isn't as significant. But on a per calorie or per meal basis, you're generally talking at least 4 to 5 times as much. If you've got small dogs, say you're somebody that just has your pug, you're talking maybe the difference between 50 cents a day and $2 a day. You know what I mean? It's like the quantitative difference isn't that much. You can live with it. For me, with two St. Bernards and another large dog, you're talking about potentially a difference between $25 a day and $125 a day. So it's just like a not complete non-starter for a lot of folks. And so we tried to make a product that was like truly low in carbohydrate content, like a raw diet typically is, but also sold in a kibble form so that the price is like something that people can stomach.
Okay. And I love that because those are the kinds of options, and I'll tell you that I'm always looking for as well when traveling. We do RV trips a lot. We go into the mountains, and traveling with frozen packs of dog food, not always the most convenient.
Absolutely.
If they thaw out, you know, they'll go bad quickly, so I can't. It's a lot for us. And I know a lot of families who travel with their dogs, they need easy and, you know, available. That's another thing. For families who can't afford maybe even a more expensive kibble, is it better to at least have maybe half of the good kibble and then half of the kibble that keeps them, you know, in their budget?
Yeah, so for let me tell you how I approach matters of shopping. If I didn't own a dog food company and I just had to apply an intellectual framework to making decisions for what food to feed my dogs. Number one, of course, it needs to be something that's going to provide all the vitamins and minerals that the dog needs to avoid deficiency diseases, which is a real thing. Fortunately, if you purchase a commercial product in the United States, a packaged product that you find at a pet store or over the internet, it's incredibly likely that it's something that satisfies that entire nutritional profile. If you make it for yourself, there's greater risk, and you can find, if you try really hard, small producers that don't satisfy those requirements. But one place that the regulators do a nice job is they understand, they take every year, they look at the body of evidence on how much vitamin A and how much thiamine and all these other various things your dog needs. And they make sure, they require that everybody that's making commercial products does all that. So that's number one. Number two, is my dog going to eat it?
Yeah.
Pretty big fundamental consideration. Yes. If the dog isn't going to eat it, that's kind of a big issue. For me, number three is I want to minimize carbohydrate and maximize protein. The amount of protein the dog's evolutionary ancestors ate for the vast majority, 99.9% of their evolutionary heritage, more than 50% of the calories came from protein. It is very difficult to find a commercially prepared pet food product in America today that has more than 50% protein. So the logic of as much maximize protein and minimize carbohydrate tends to hold and be good advice in 9 out of 10 cases for my money. And so, yeah, if you're talking about, look, I can't afford our kibble, in the world of kibble, is relatively expensive. It is one of the pricier kibbles because we use more meat and less carbohydrate than everybody else. And so typically folks that are switching from a product, say like Blue Buffalo, onto ours are going to have some degree of, oh my gosh, that's so expensive. And it's not like, I always like pause a little bit here because it's not like it's expensive. It's just we've all become very habituated to incredibly inexpensive products.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like,
we've settled a little bit too with quality and understanding that higher quality costs more. It's like, yes, but maybe less vet bills.
And it's what, that's a tough one because to me it's like, well, and the dog, but the dog's going to live longer. There will be fewer vet bills, except for the fact that it's going to live longer. You're going to have a longer period with vet.
Paying for dog food. I get it. I'd rather that though than the, you know.
So would I.
My money go to a vet bill and seeing my dog not well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Choices.
But it's like the if you switched from the per calorie price of like McDonald's, like think of the junkiest human food you can think of, basically, it's 10 times as much as a calorie of fancy kibble. Okay. And so you're talking about phenomenally inexpensive things. And so switching to us does have a certain amount of like change your budget, sticker shock. But yeah, if you can feed, we have folks, plenty of folks that do it. Both the things you highlighted, sometimes I travel, sometimes there are just a variety of places where preparing a raw product is not right for me. And so we make the next best thing for those people. And if you can only feed us part of the time, that's a step in the right direction as well.
Absolutely. So when I started helping rescuing dogs because I had adopted my own, a big thing I would come across is like no corn, no wheat, no soy. And that seemed enough. Like maybe if I bought any food that didn't have that, we were like, yay, okay, I'm doing good. As years go on and you learn more, there's certain dogs that are allergic to certain ingredients. I have one that's allergic to salmon. I can't have any salmon in any of her food, but the other one's allergic to chicken. He'll break out in hives and just itch. So I have to have his food not be chicken. I know a lot of times we have to think with our pocketbook, but your money is going to go further and you are going to save money in the long run when you take a look at the quality of what you're buying and how much you're spending, which is why I love to find out more about keto natural pet foods. Do you have turkey, beef, pork, like different kinds of proteins? And is there no corn, no wheat, no soy in them? What's it like to have that kibble?
So we have two and shortly three different main kibble recipes. One is grounded in chicken, one is salmon, and the new one is lamb. And that's not in the market yet. So those are our three options: white meat, red meat, seafood. Sounds like in your household, it might not be ideal options.
Well, we have two of our girls on seafood. I'm telling you, my house is crazy. I have like...
Ours is kind of too, honestly. We have both of those, the chicken and salmon in our house and use with different dogs. But
we do fish and turkey in our house, and one of them does chicken, or she can eat actually any of them. So when I run out, my doggy Francis, who's a lab pit mix, a rescue mama dog, she can eat anything. She's so sweet. So that gives me some flexibility because then I'm able to save money or switch foods easily when I run out of one or I'm traveling, which is kind of nice.
We're something of a startup. We were founded in 2017 and we're not a large company. And so when you're something I've learned about that I didn't know about the pet food industry at the time I was writing my book, but I've learned while running a business that makes pet food, is that there's kind of a well-established product line expansion path. That like, if you're a startup pet food company, as amazing as cats can be, and I don't own any cats, but I do like cats, you can't go, your dollars, each person, each St. Bernard owner is worth as much to a pet food company as 20 cat owners, if that makes sense. And so your dollars are so important in these early stages, you have to like spend them very wisely or you just sink and you don't go. And so you have to expand your products according to kind of a pretty well established line where it's like, get all the adult dog ones out first, then you make puppy and senior for dogs, then you can go into cats. And that's kind of how it goes. And so that's, none of this would be, if somebody, a benevolent financier were to fall out of the sky and give us all the money in the world and we could make all kinds of products, I'd be making additional types. I know how to make kibble without carbohydrate and it's a cool thing. And we could make a variety of different kinds of things, but it just takes time to develop.
Right. And, you know, to be honest, that's what I do love. I noticed it when I went to your website. It's kind of, it feels a little bit boutique. It feels a little more personalized, or like I can actually, like I said, when we have so many choices, you just get overwhelmed. I've been on other online websites that offer foods and you know, I went to them because they had one human grade cooked food and suddenly they have the canned version and the kibble version and the freeze dried and the this and that. And it just became so much that I was like, okay, so is the original one that I wanted to buy not good? Like you start to get crazy in your head, you know? So it's nice to keep it simple, at least while you guys are growing, introducing us slowly to something.
It is. It makes it easy. Yeah, it makes it easy. Our way of doing, like, I guess, you know, you're talking about the boutique quality and the fact that it can feel kind of like small coming to our site. That I'm not sure that we always want to feel small.
Maybe personalized is the word.
So that's sort of what I was trying to say. It's like personal.
Yes.
I do a lot of these kinds of interviews and we even film our, like I'm putting out content and making myself as the top of the company available to our consumers to ask questions and have dialogue with all the time. And that is critical. And it's something we can do better as we're small, but that's something that's like completely missing from the pet food industry. Like good luck trying to get the CEO of any one of these companies to come on and just defend the logic and philosophy that they use to make their product on your show. You know, there might be so many darn pet food products that you get lost in Petco, but good luck getting one other CEO willing to come and let you ask whatever you want of me, let you say whatever you want to me, and I'm going to explain to you where we're the best, where we're not the best, all that. It's just like, that's a quality that we definitely strive for.
And I really appreciate that, Daniel. I appreciate your time too, because in having you on the show, you're the only person and the only company that I've had aside from, you know, dog trainers and a veterinarian, we focus on dog rescue organizations and founders of nonprofit dog rescue organizations, you know, saving dogs or offering people different ways to get involved with dog advocacy. And I found when I saw your site and I found this option, I thought, this is an important part of that advocacy, is how to feed our dogs properly. And I think it's number one.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's hard to think of, if you approach animal welfare from something like a, you know, $10 word, but utilitarian perspective, where we're talking about minimizing the suffering of the most, it's hard to argue against eradicating a disease that has the same impact as a lifetime of smoking. As long as we're working in a way that helps minimize to some degree the impact of obesity on dogs, I feel pretty good about the fact that we're having an overall positive impact. We're literally filming our own podcast, videocast, where the subject was squarely focused on that. We like review the labels of other pet food products and try to talk to consumers about what the various things mean. And so, yeah, the one we were doing today is just a word salad of holistic, wholesome, healthy, high quality, just stuff that you could apply wherever. It means nothing. It means nothing. And it's the main angle. And it's a shame that, you know, like that's such a prevalent thing, and that numbers based stuff that actually has been shown to do something, you know, the percentage of a product that is one ingredient or one nutrient or another is not like a defined sector of the market.
Which is why I always implore to my listeners, whether it's dog adoption, veterinary care, now pet nutrition, empower yourselves by learning and doing the research. Even with dog trainers, like, do the homework, find out recommendations, reviews, people tell stories, you know, about experiences they've had at any one place or with any one product. And that speaks volumes. So don't just fall for the expensive ads or the TV commercials, because they're, you know, in front of your face all the time. I'm huge on doing homework.
Don't run away if 20% of the content feels over your head. Like, view that as a good indicator. I always, that's how it feels to me. If I feel somewhat confused by the subject matter that's being presented to me, I view that as a good thing. It's like, okay, I need to learn, get up to speed with this, but it's an indication that it's not being reduced to stuff that I might be able to digest easily, but at the expense of it being false.
Which is what you were saying earlier, all the words that sound good and I'm like, oh, this is all positive, but they're not really telling me anything.
Exactly. But it's like they're done at a high level because these big companies have tested and they found out that it works. For the greatest number of people, they want to sell to the greatest number of people. You can't risk saying something that's hard to follow along with and that requires a little bit of evaluation and analysis. Much easier to just slap a dog with a wagging tail, you know, or a wolf on the bag, and then use the word ancestral, and we're good to go.
And I will say, you know, and to your merit too, with being focused on good quality of pet nutrition, is that there are dog rescues in the United States, some who have been on the podcast, who say to their supporters and their followers and adopters, you know, we need donations, yes, but please know that we feed our dogs a very specific type of diet. There's senior dog rescues who can't just give those dogs just any food. There's the pug rescue who has had some sponsorship from a certain type of food because pugs have such, you know, specific needs at times. So it's nice to know that also in animal advocacy and dog rescue, a lot of dog rescue founders are hip to the idea of better nutrition does keep these dogs healthier, longer lives, less vet bills.
Yeah, it's great. That's great. For how, like, underfunded and cash-strapped those organizations can often be, it's nice to see that kind of commitment, because I know that that pressure is real to, like, look, we need to keep the dog alive and we need to keep the lights on. What we do, you know, I mention it because it's relevant, not to pat ourselves on the back, but when we bring new people in, we say, if you want to try our product, we give you a full guarantee, a 30-day guarantee, where if your dog doesn't like it or you come to regret the decision or whatever, we'll give you all of your money back and you don't have to mail it back to us, as long as you give it away to some kind of needy cause, even if it's like either a rescue or even just a friend, somebody, like, make productive use of it in some kind of way, and we'll give you your full money back, no problem. That's our like one little way of contributing at the moment, although I am in the process of starting a nonprofit of my own. And it is kind of cool. It's like, it's unique. It's a thing that doesn't tug at the heartstrings as much as some of the work that you do, but I view it as very important, which is basically advocating for pet owner rights, something that would actively try to improve the quality of scientific research that's conducted in ways that impacts pet owners, improve educational efforts, and improve regulatory systems. So it's like, we don't all have to shop in a world where we're not told how much of the most important nutrients are in there. I think we'd all make better decisions for our pets if we could shop in a world like we were shopping for ourselves.
Absolutely. That sounds fascinating. Sounds like a follow-up episode next season for us when you're ready.
I could do, look, I mean, I haven't said the letters DCM yet. And let me tell you, if you want to talk about grain-free diets and the issue of dilated cardiomyopathy, we could have a 3-hour show going right now, because I've just done a lot on that front too. I'm at the center of it. Like I was telling you before we were on air, the amount of prep that you do as a professional podcaster is such a breath of fresh air for somebody like me, because often I'm interviewed by people who learn my name 5 minutes before the show. And it's like, you clearly do your stuff. And so I'm here to be, anytime you want me back, I'll come back. I'll talk about whatever you want to talk about, nonprofits, DCM, whatever.
Thank you, Daniel. Yes, you know, now that you bring up DCM, and if you don't mind just touching upon it, at least by definition, because we had Dr. Palmquist talk about it last season, but listeners who listen to this episode might not have heard that one, and I'd love to just give them the little rundown, if it's possible. I know it's a big topic, but it's an important one.
Yep. There is a, in the summer of 2018, the United States Food and Drug Administration put out a press release that said, we are beginning to investigate whether essentially grain-free pet foods are causing a otherwise pretty rare doggy heart disease called dilated cardiomyopathy, which is, you know, acronym is DCM. The FDA's investigation got massive press coverage. It was covered extensively in the New York Times and in the Washington Post and all sorts of other places. And it led a cluster of veterinarians from major academic institutions, one at Tufts University, one at the University of Florida, one at UC Davis in California, to push really hard the idea that there is indeed some kind of association. There's evidence of some sort of association between these products and this disease. And so in a lot of corners of the pet owning and pet food buying world, folks came to believe that there might be something here, that I don't want to give them, because DCM is a deadly disease and it is as serious as diseases get. And if your dog gets it, it's a really, really bad thing. And so justifiably, folks got very worried about whether they were going to buy something they thought was healthier. I bought a grain-free product that's supposed to be the good stuff. And in reality, they risk giving their dogs a disease. That's the overall synopsis of the issue. What's really gone on, and I know this because I've been involved in Freedom of Information Act litigation against the FDA for the past 3 years, and because I've done a whole bunch of relevant scientific stuff with journals, that is not the whole story by any stretch. And I will tell you right now two things that you can lock me in on. Number one, there is zero evidence of an association between any broad class of pet food products and DCM. You can give a dog DCM by feeding it the wrong things, particularly if you don't give it enough of specific amino acids. Amino acids are they're the building blocks of protein. If you give your dog the wrong kind of protein and don't give it the stuff it needs, you can develop DCM in your dog. But the idea that grain-free pet foods or pet foods that contain one ingredient, potatoes or legumes or something like that, cause DCM, there is zero evidence to support it. The entire thing basically came about through, and this is the second big statement that I will make on the record, they came about through fraud, capital F fraud, by folks who are making a lot of money promoting that idea. And that is the kind of thing you asked for it, so I'm giving it to you. But here's the thing. I know anytime I say all this in a 5-minute version of this, you and your listeners can't tell whether I am a guy wearing a tinfoil hat or whether I'm a super serious person who's on the vanguard of this issue. It's the kind of thing you need to go into the weeds to understand the details to judge that. And so right now your listeners will have to leave uncertainty surrounding that. But the deeper you go, it's just one of these things. It's very much like the story I told in my book, where it's just like...
Do you talk about it in your book, DCM?
No, I wrote the book before this controversy
occurred. Oh, that was
before.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
And so it's kind of a weird... It's like I follow what's interesting to me, and I go hard on what's interesting to me. And so it's like I've been involved in this issue very deeply, even though we're not really implicated by it. But it's just another example of industry influencing the veterinary community and the veterinary community influencing pet owners and creating this absurd story that's moved. I mean, the pet food market, the impact of this controversy has been in the billions of dollars a year. Colossal impact by far. You know, I read all these pet food journals, basically, and no issues of pet food crossover into the mainstream ever. this one did. And it's just like one of the very few times where you, if you go to the dog park and you go like, hey, do you know about the grain-free heart disease
people
thing?
People
will be like, oh yeah, I read about that. I know about that. And it's just colossal. And it's just a House of Cards story that's just completely ridiculous. And I love talking about it because I just know a lot about it. And it's an absurd story.
It's crazy that when I first read about it, it was an article. And here was the tip off to me that I'm like, I don't know about this. I mean, I'm going to be careful and read more. But I read this whole really long article. And then I saw it posted by different organizations, pet rescue organizations, on their feeds warning people, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh. And then people saying, oh, my gosh, my dog died of DCM. And it was because I fed it, you know, this and that and the other. But when I read the article that first turned me on to the idea of this, the existence of this connection they were trying to make between the pet foods and DCM, it was published by one of the biggest, and I won't name it, one of the biggest dog food companies in the United States.
I mean, that's basically that's the rub.
Yeah, and that company was saying that they didn't have that food, that they discovered it in other foods and blah, blah.
Turns out.
And I'm like, oh, so is this a gimmick, an ad? Is this like for profit? Like they were trying to take business away from a lot of companies that were much smaller than they were, but that offered that grain-free option.
Yeah, and that's basically, like, I referred to three veterinarians before as being the folks who kind of did the laboring work to promote this issue in the academic press, and in they were the ones who were getting interviewed by the Washington Post, by the New York Times, and working with FDA, small cluster of folks. I've explained in a lot of writing that I've done that if your listeners poke around the internet, you'll have no trouble finding the amount of money those folks have taken from this really small group of really large companies that are share one quality, which is that they are the only companies in the world that are not implicated by the theory of these veterinarians. These veterinarians basically are like, your dog might get DCM unless you feed it food made by one of these three companies, and that's it. And they just happen to be the three companies that are paying all this money to these folks, and they just happen to be the companies whose their financial performance, since this became an issue, has gone through the roof. They're just like years of stagnant growth where just like as grain-free and Blue Buffalo and companies like that became more popular, people leaned into it more. These guys couldn't grow. This thing came out and all of a sudden it's like they're, you know, Amazon or Tesla or something like that. And it's just complete nonsense.
I know. And I don't like to feel taken. And that's why when I read things, I have to verify. I have to know who wrote it and what are they backed by and are they in cahoots with anyone? You know, it's a snowball effect, but we have to.
But it's like, you have to be, I'm like, you know, the title I use on our web series is I'm a complete charlatan with a massive financial conflict of interest. Because like, I run a pet food company. I just want to be, that doesn't mean I am inherently untrustworthy, but it does mean you should be looking at that and you should be trying to understand how that shapes my opinions. And it also means I have an obligation to tell you. That's kind of the main thing that's a problem here, is that these folks try to present themselves as like, no, we're impartial veterinarians that are interested in the truth. We work in the ivory tower and we're not doing anything like that. And that was not the reality. And so being forward, you know, it's like, I view it as an obligation.
Well, there's going to be a lot of reading material available to our listeners after this podcast episode. So on that note, Daniel, tell me, where can our listeners find and follow you so they can research your work, purchase your book, look into keto natural pet foods?
You can buy the book at, you know, anyone, whatever your preferred kind of retailer is, Amazon or whatever. If you want to buy or take a look at the products that my company makes, you go to ketonaturalpetfoods.com. There's more information than you could digest in a week there, and you can judge it for yourself. I am on a variety of social media platforms, but the vast majority of the writing that I do is at the professional level. It's conference type stuff, and it's kind of geared towards that audience. And so I'm not great about self-promoting little nuggets of digestible information. The company does an okay job. If you follow Keto Natural Pet Foods, things I've referred to, like our little videos and stuff like that, I have people helping me get those out, as opposed to my, like, that's not my forte. And so.
Does Keto Natural Pet Foods have an Instagram or a Facebook page?
Yep, all of it.
Perfect.
All of it. I don't think you'll have any trouble finding it.
Awesome. So I will have those live links in the show notes for this episode so anyone can easily scroll down and find ketonanatural.com. dog food. We are going to put those out so you guys can do your research, give it a try if you feel so inclined. Write to the company, write to Daniel and tell him your thoughts about the product, please. I think that would be really cool, and let him know.
I answer every email that I get that's not somebody being rude and is not somebody dealing with stuff at a, you know, low level of just insults.
Yeah, wasting your time. Let's be honest. I mean, we all have better things to do, but we've got to stay positive. To my listeners, I always want to just empower you, give you information and resources so you can make really good decisions for yourselves and your furry family members. Our listeners should also know that I am not getting paid to advocate for any individual or organization on this podcast. I choose to interview guests that I know are doing the good work of helping and educating pet parents across America for the good of all dogs. Thank you so much, Daniel, for this conversation.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for doing all that, like, for taking this so seriously. It's a real service. Thank you.
Absolutely. It means so much to me. It's really important. You know, my dogs are like my babies, and, you know, I'm raising a human son too, so.
You got a big family if your dogs are like your babies. Six of them, my God.
Yeah, our six-year-old is now learning to, like, you know, he scoops up the poop and he's helps me
feed. Yeah, you gotta put him to work.
He's gotta do the work.
Absolutely.
It's fantastic. So thank you again, and I hope we can have you back maybe next season.
Yep, sure. You know how to find me.
Okay.
Thanks, Jackie.
This is a big topic that could seriously go on for episodes. But I hope I've given you enough of an introduction to spark your interest in looking at what is in your dog's food, and maybe you'll want to check out Daniel's book and his dog food, Ketona Natural. And if you do, drop him a line and let him know. I personally believe that we are what we eat, and so are our dogs. I want to leave you with some information that can be found on the back of a Ketona Natural pet food's back. It says, scientific evidence does show that dogs and cats will live their best lives when they avoid dietary carbohydrates as much as possible. So why are carbs the most abundant nutrient in so many premium and ultra-premium kibbles? For all the expensive pet food and flashy marketing claims out there, obesity, cancer, osteoarthritis, and other chronic health conditions are still harming our pets at staggering levels. The status quo simply isn't working. The Keto Natural website also has a free online library of videos, articles, books, and scientific papers from a plethora of writers designed to help consumers understand what's really best for their pets. I say, with so many choices when it comes to what we need to buy and use for our pets, the truth is out there. We just have to find it amongst the noise. Thank you for joining me for this episode. Please press subscribe on our podcast and tell all of your dog-loving friends about it. Until next time, hang on to those leashes.
The Canine Condition. Come, sit, stay.